The threat landscape has diversified. What has been highlighted by this strategy is the fact that critical infrastructure is very much the focus now.
So who would have thought in 2019 that suddenly the manufacturers of PPE would be so critical, or the logistic companies ferrying food and goods suddenly critical?
So many of the issues that actually were foreshadowed in the previous cybersecurity strategy or previous strategic documents of government, so much of the future is rushing at us now. It's all coming to pass.
We've failed to drive cost into criminals, there's no doubt. We've in fact driven cost into our own operations.
What does it mean for the Australian people? Because it seems a little bit stratospheric at the moment and straight out of a Bond movie. What does it actually mean? What's the impact on the Australian people? What's the impact on their everyday lives? That needs to be translated.
The Prime Minister has said in public comments that it should be a buyer beware approach to those users who do use TikTok. And I think for the 6 million Australians using TikTok, a buyer beware approach does imply they need some level of knowledge about that threat landscape.
G'day. Welcome to this special episode of the National Security Podcast. I'm Chris Farnham, and this is the podcast that looks at the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. This podcast is brought to you by policyforum.net and the National Security College at the ANU. And those comments you just heard came from Alastair McGibbon, Gay Brotman, Rory Medcalf, and podcast host Catherine Manstead. We will be back to hear more from them on the recently released Australia Cyber Security Strategy for 2020, right after this break.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Australia has just released the 2020 Cybersecurity Strategy, a follow-up to the last strategy of 2016 and a much-awaited document for industry, the community and, of course, government at large. With me in the socially distanced studio today to talk about the strategy, we have three experts. Gay Brotman, who's the former Shadow Minister for Cybersecurity and Shadow Assistant Minister for Defence. We also have Alastair McGibbon, currently the Chief Strategy Officer at CyberCX, and before that, the National Cyber Security Advisor and the head of the Australian Cyber Security Centre. Both Gay and Alastair are also members of the National Security College's Futures Council. Finally, last but not least, we have Professor Rory Medcalf, who is the head of the National Security College. We've just had the new release of Australia's cybersecurity strategy. Things move fast in the cyber world. So Adam Segal, a US analyst, says that 2012 was cyber year zero, the year where we first had the beginnings of geopolitical manoeuvring in cyberspace. That was the year we had revelations about the Stuxnet attack on Iranian nuclear centrifuges, Iran's damaging attacks against the financial sector in the US, and, of course, Chinese IP theft ramping up dramatically at that time. Australia first entered into this scene in a very public way with its first cyber strategy in 2016. We now have the second one. What, from your perspective, do you think has changed in terms of the landscape that we have now in cybersecurity, both in terms of the threat landscape and the ecosystem for defence and resilience in Australia since 2016 and now in 2020? Alastair, I might start with you on that one.
So we know that 2016 was the first fully funded, ambitious strategy. It wasn't the first time the Australian government had ventured into that space. In fact, it had done that well before 2012, just for the record. But 2016 with Prime Minister Turnbull, I think, set the benchmark for quite an ambitious strategy. And we often said that it was as much about the opportunity of getting cybersecurity right than the consequences of getting it wrong. And I do think sparked a discussion in Australia, spurned an industry. There's no doubt we saw an uptick in domestic cybersecurity skills and in technology companies and in service providers. And we certainly saw the bureaucracy become more aligned. Never perfectly. I mean, everyone that's ever worked in the bureaucracy knows that that sausage is pretty interesting to see how it gets made. But I think it was a good start. 2020, we see an emphasis on other things, but I'll leave that to others to start that conversation, I suspect.
Gay, how has the threat landscape changed or matured since 2016?
I think the threat landscape has, it's diversified, but what has been highlighted by this strategy is the fact that critical infrastructure is very much the focus now. And I welcomed the initiatives that are outlined in this strategy in terms of addressing those threats to the critical infrastructure. There's been discussion in the critical infrastructure sector for some time about the fact that we need to broaden out what actually constitutes critical infrastructure. At the moment, Australia's got 8 sectors covered, and the rest of the world have got, particularly like-mindeds, have got much more than that. And so what is a really good thing from this strategy, one of the upsides of the strategy is the fact that it has focused on critical infrastructure and the threats against critical infrastructure, also focused on the fact that we actually need to broaden out what actually constitutes critical infrastructure, particularly in terms of our democratic institutions and our national institutions. So I'm looking forward to seeing how the government responds in terms of broadening out the definition of critical infrastructure, what will actually be included. I'm particularly keen to see that our democratic institutions such as the AEC as well as our national institutions are included. But it's good having this conversation now about critical infrastructure. I think that in the past, particularly around 2016, it was still very early days, but the government responded in some ways to the latest threats in 2018 with that body of legislation that went through Parliament on critical infrastructure. In my view, it was still a bit underdone. It didn't address some of the key issues in the key sectors that needed to be included, but it was a good start.
In fact, there are only 5 sectors currently regulated. Mm. TSSR brings in the telecommunications companies, which is clearly vital. And then you've got the SOCI Act, which looks at oil and gas or gas, water, electricity and ports. But as Gay said, that's a pretty narrow list. And so what this strategy talks about is broadening that out. My understanding, about 15 or so sectors. So you have space, you have data and cloud, really vital things. And we know that, you know, David Irvin, has talked about spreading that out. And, you know, for those who don't know David Irvin, he chairs FIRB, the Foreign Investment Review Board, which is really a critical part now of national security. So there's a good move there towards more critical infrastructure.
Yes.
One of the things the strategy mentions quite a lot is the COVID-19 pandemic. I think in 50 pages or under of a strategy, it's mentioned some 15 times. And one of the things that I think that pandemic's pointed out to all of us is sometimes what you assess at a point in time is critical and important, doesn't capture future threats down the line. So who would have thought in Australia in 2019 that suddenly the manufacturers of PPE would be so critical, or the logistic companies ferrying food and goods to your local Woolworths, suddenly critical. Alistair, can I stay with you for a moment here on critical infrastructure? Is there a risk that by focusing in on certain sectors, we might exclude or undervalue those sectors which do such critical work in the economy or to our society, but just the threat profile isn't there yet, or we haven't realised what the potential threats or vulnerabilities are?
Well, as Gay said, I think you've got to eat the elephant from one end, as I bring another analogy. And, you're welcome. You can have me anytime. I'm here all week. Well, eating elephant, if you're going to do it, you start at one end. You start with critical infrastructure. It's really vital. And if you look at the strategy, in terms of what can be considered quite light, it spends more effort on talking about critical infrastructure. So that telegraphs where I think the government's going. If people are reading the strategy, I'd recommend looking at paragraph 36, which start signalling to the broader market what the intention of government is in terms of regulating responsibility on directors and officers. And it talks about things like the Consumer Law, the Privacy Act. It flags the potential for Corporations Act when it talks about directors and officers' responsibilities. That captures a much broader part of the economy because you're right. I mean, you don't know what's vital, particularly in a supply chain world. And when you deal in cybersecurity, we know third parties bring an awful lot of risk to us. So where do you draw the edge of what you want to protect? This document actually, if you look at that paragraph 36 and then combine it with sort of 52 to 59, download it and have a look if you're listening, that actually flags this concept of driving responsibility towards those that own and operate what is now everywhere a critical piece of infrastructure, which is your IT operations.
I think for readers playing along at home who don't want to download it, 36 has three lines of effort that the government flags it will be focused on. And I want to come to a number of these in our conversation. The first is, as Alastair mentioned, the potentiality for duties to be imposed on company directors and other business entities in relation to their cybersecurity responsibilities. The second is considering more deeply the role of privacy, consumer and data protection laws, which I think is quite key. And the last one there is obligations on manufacturers of internet connected devices. I'm sure we've all seen the statistics. They vary from the kind of more realistic to the sublime slash ridiculous on how many Internet of Things connected devices will exist in the world by 2030. It ranges from some 20 billion to 60 billion. It's a lot. And it's definitely something that this strategy is pivoting towards. Can I take you into the conversation, or bring you into the conversation, Rory, on these points? The strategy is very clear that addressing cybersecurity is a team sport, as it were. Right from the beginning, the Home Affairs Minister's forward, he says that cybersecurity is a shared responsibility. And the entire report is split up into three parts, actions for government, actions for business and actions for the community. To what extent is this kind of the new normal now for national security issues and security writ more large, that it's something that government alone no longer has to, take full responsibility for, but that we're asking our citizens and our businesses to step up and start to play in what is actually a pretty broad geopolitical game as well?
Yeah, so it should have been the normal all along, I guess. But I think when you asked at the beginning about what's changed in the risk landscape in the past few years, so many of the issues that actually were foreshadowed in the previous cybersecurity strategy or previous strategic documents of government, so much of the future is rushing at us now. It's all sort of coming to pass. And that is risks that are at a whole of society level, whether it's the pandemic, whether it's in fact the scale of and the constant nature of cyber intrusions and cyber attacks on Australia and other countries in recent years, whether it's now the shocks to the economy and of course the intersection with environmental shocks as well, the terrible bushfires we've had in this country. So all of this adds up to national security is your problem too, whether you're a member of civil society, just an ordinary citizen, whether you're working in a university, whether you're working in any area of the private sector. And I think it's absolutely clear that the private sector and indeed in a country like Australia, state governments, local governments, all these layers of authority, you're all at the front line. Anyone who's connected to the internet is potentially at, which is basically everyone, is connected to the front line of national security risk and responsibility. And I think one of the I hate to say the term, but I think one of the silver linings of the crises that we're going through at the moment is that awareness that we're all responsible, and that if we expect the state to step forward and protect our health, our welfare, our freedom of expression, our physical safety, whatever it might be, we're going to have to contribute too. So I think it is time for that new narrative. And look, I think this is not a bad strategy. It is building on very strong foundations, but it probably could have played harder into that idea that obligation is on everyone, not just on business, but also, for example, in this country, on all levels of government. I think there's some data recently that state governments have experienced a very high proportion of cyber attacks, intrusion, I guess potential sabotage, and certainly information gathering in recent years.
I think that's a really important point, that everyone is on the front lines, and I'm not sure this is something that is yet in the zeitgeist, that everyone is understands that this threat profile. The strategy has a lot of high level and alarming statistics in it. So in 2019, 1 in 3 Australian adults were impacted by cybercrime. It also looks at the number of threats that the Australian Cyber Security Centre responds to, which is experiencing a massive uptick in incidents at a rate of almost 6 per day. So the strategy is full of numbers and data points that paint a pretty bleak picture. But if you were to be thinking about this from the perspective of communicating to the community, you know, Daniel Kahneman, who is the father of behavioural economics, talks to us about the way in which humans, all of us, process information. If you give a bunch of data points to people that suggest they should rationally behave in a certain way, it often doesn't have that effect. Whereas if you tell them a story with those classic 5 W's of journalism, who, what, where, why, how, that prompts action. Now, it occurs to me in the strategy, while there's lots of these numbers, when it comes to telling the story of our recent cyber intrusions, it's pretty light on. There's one text box which calls out a recent sophisticated state-sponsored actor responsible for some serious breaches across the economy and across government, but it doesn't really tell us much about the who, what, why, when, or even why we should care about that. Alistair, I'll go back to you and then bring the others into the conversation. Does government need to do better at actually making the threats and incidences we face relatable and believable and authentic to people?
Yep. So I'm going to call this the barbecue conversation. When I started getting involved in stopping cybercrime back in the early 2000s in the Federal Police, and I was at a barbecue and said to people I investigated cybercrime or tried to stop it, people would ask why. Now, because is it such a thing? And now everyone knows someone that has been the victim of an event, an identity stolen, credit card taken, you know, or they've identified scams trying to be perpetrated against them in perpetuity, you know, by criminals. And we've failed to drive cost into criminals. There's no doubt. We've in fact driven cost into our own operations. That's bad math. But you're right. I mean, so I think when it comes to cybercrime, telling stories works. I think when we talk about cybersecurity incidents, they do as well, because most people, I think when you hear about nation state actors, and they are real for those listening out there, we know that there are sophisticated state-based actors that will come after our information. They will map out our critical infrastructure. We know they're there. But most people think, well, how does that impact me? We haven't done a great job, and I'm one of those people that failed in telling that story, in saying why it actually matters to the punter on the street. It does actually matter. We've not done a great job of articulating, because most of them would just say it's spy versus spy stuff, and it's kind of a bit cool, but I don't know what I'm meant to do. What action should I take, back to Rory's point, as this team sport thing? What can I do against a sophisticated state-based actor? The answer is, spoiler alert, a lot. If you own a piece of critical infrastructure, if you run an IT system, you can actually make it much tougher for those threat actors.
This seems as good as any time to go to a quick ad break. We'll be back straight after this message for more things on cybersecurity and Australia's new strategy.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Okay, what should we be doing to bridge that gap between, kind of, we know that there are these sophisticated state actors out there, but what can people do? How can we empower that conversation?
Well, I think we need to be having the conversation about what's actually happening on the threat front. So there have been the industry panel called for the threat report to be reintroduced. And so sharing that conversation with the Australian people about what is actually happening in terms of the macro state-based threats, I think is useful. But also we need to do a call to action for the Australian people. I've long advocated for a slip, slop, slap campaign. And I know that the industry panels also mentioned that too, as well as others in the industry. A call to action explaining the dynamics of the environment and the threats to the environment, but we want them to feel empowered in this environment. We don't want them to feel overwhelmed by it or frightened off by it so that they don't get engaged, because we want them engaged so that they can enjoy the benefits of an internet environment and the prosperity that comes from that. So we want them engaged. We just need to empower them. And yes, being upfront about the actual nature of the threats and where the threats are coming from and what we're going to be doing in response to that, but also being upfront about the nature of cybercrime. I mean, with the stats around 1 in 3 Australians have been victims of cybercrime, that it costs the Australian economy about $29 billion. It's significant. As Alistair said, most Australians know someone who has had their ID theft, their identity thieved, or they've been a victim of some phishing scam or some other cyber criminal activity. So we need to actually explain, be open with the Australian people about this, trust the Australian people that they can actually grip this up and understand it and be compelled to actually act, give them the tools to do that, to be empowered in that environment. But most of all, we need to do a call to action. I've been pushing for this for a very long time. I know that this strategy has a public funding for a public awareness campaign, but I think it's $4.9 million over potentially 10 years. I don't know how much impact that's going to have. Just a simple call to action and they'll be there.
You can, as we know, there are two types. We can break it down to two types of threat actors: nation states and criminals. Yeah. And the treatment of them is different in terms of how you can react as a systems owner and operator. The analogy or the joke about not needing to run faster than the bear, I've just got to run faster than you as the bear's chasing us, works with criminals. So to Gay's point, there are things we can do as an economy-wide. A course of action that reduces the likelihood of Australians being victimised by criminals. And I say that because every criminal I've ever met online, I've met a lot over the years, is agnostic to where they get their money from. They don't care if they're stealing it from an American, a Brit, someone from Japan, or someone from Australia. They just want cash, they want identities, they want things they can parlay to cash. That's where we can actually just run faster than the others that are running from the bear. Right, we need to drive cost into criminals. We also need to make it harder for them to target our population. When it comes to nation states and nation state threat actors, when they're on mission and they are tasked with collecting against key priority assets in a nation, tougher call. But I'd like to sort wheat from chaff here. I would like us to make it harder for criminals. This strategy, by the way, goes quite some way of doing that. There's significant more money to the Australian Federal Police, an extra 100 detectives or so. That's good. I've been a pretty vocal critic, even though I was in the Federal Police, that they have been a bit absent from this space. And generally, police all around the country haven't really risen to this challenge the way they could have over the years, because you don't see it. It's like carbon monoxide. It can't really hurt you. And that goes to the storytelling that's necessary, because when you meet a victim of cybercrime, they are as victimized as a victim of offline crime. So we've got to get away from this concept of it being virtual. There's nothing virtual about the victimization that occurs. We can do a lot about crime, and I'm really glad to see it actually called out in this strategy. Nation state stuff, tougher for us, but we can still do a lot more. And that's where I think the critical infrastructure bit comes to the fore.
Rory, do we need to abolish the term sophisticated nation state actor?
I've gently commented on this term in the podcast before. I mean, each time I hear the term, I'm not sure if I can see is it John Gielgud or Jeremy Irons or who's the sophisticated actor I'm envisioning that week, I think that this strategy, just like the one in 2016, has been very polite in not naming names of state actors, sophisticated or not. It's interesting that Australian government's often accused of sort of vilifying China, for example. Pull a name randomly from a hat. And yet the word China doesn't appear anywhere in this strategy. Look, that's fine as long as there's clear public awareness and clear practical examples given to the public and the business community of case studies, the narrative you're talking about of where a state actor, whether it's China or whether it's Russia or whoever it might be, I'm not sure if it's sort of Maldives or Venezuela or whoever, but it's more likely to be China or Russia, I suspect, a case of where real harm has been done to the national interest, and there are plenty of case studies to choose from, whether it's looking at the Parliament, Bureau of Meteorology, certain universities, mm-hmm. certain corporates in the United States. And I think this is one area where, for all of the flaws that we see every day in the American system, the transparency with which court action is taken in the United States, if you look at the extraordinary detail that goes into the essentially into the process of prosecutions in the United States around, for example, sophisticated state actors from China and elsewhere, we could learn a lot from that kind of narrative being injected into the public. Into
you make
the public
a good
debate.
Point. Can I counter that, having obviously sat on the other side of
it? Was it you that crossed the word China?
No, I didn't, I promise. And I'd be happy to see country names in there. I would, because I think we've got to mature the conversation. But and I've been very supportive, by the way, of the US prosecutions, because those indictments are really powerful forensic documents, right? I mean, that's the benefit of a liberal Western democracy in a court system where you've got to play your hand if you're a prosecutor. I like it. My question
is Australian
to you,
targets. Some of those are actually
yes, of course,
Australian targets,
yeah.
And they're named in American court documents,
yep.
Not in Australian documents.
I know. I'm conscious of that. My question is whether that's because they're a superpower and they can do those things. And I wonder whether as a middle or small power, it's much tougher to name. In Australia, in defence of the government, and I no longer work there, but in defence of the government, it would have been unheard of 6 years ago to any country.
Yep.
You wouldn't have called out Russia for the Cisco smart feature, I call flaw, abuse that the Russians did in 2000, I think it was April 2017. You wouldn't have called out China in December of 2017 and being involved in the Cloud Hopper, big MSS, massive, I really aggressive attack.
And this stuff's all on the public record.
Yeah,
now.
It is. So
can
you
I
wouldn't
just
have
jump,
had nations. Yeah, go.
Can I just jump in there? I mean, you mentioned that was a very, the Cloud Hopper malware was very aggressive. That attribution statement, which Australia put out in December of 2018,
last
came out
working day before Christmas.
Exactly. That take the trash out day.
With many others.
Which I can add. Yeah, but let's talk about that. So that was when we went out with a whole range of other countries. And so a lot of that timing depends on other people. You're right. I've got to say, if you're going to name a country, you name it on a day when it gets picked up. So it wasn't a take out the trash timing. That was a coordinating with your allies and a lot of other countries who came out and named. So it's not like Australia doesn't name.
And December is not so weak in the news cycle of other countries.
No, exactly. No, that is the point. It just happens to be a very Australian thing, at least a couple of Christmas ago. It may not be the same this Christmas.
Could more be done about that, though, I suppose? I mean, that example is not necessarily one that is our barbecue stopper conversation. Could we have, once we make that attribution statement, find ways to then make it digestible and translatable to everyday mums and dads and businesses in a different way?
And I suspect if we had Toby Feakin, the cyber ambassador, sitting here with us, he'd say Australia would choose to name a country when it suits Australia's interests. And you heard the Prime Minister saying that in June when he didn't name the sophisticated state-based threat actor. And he'd say, we do that at our own choosing when it benefits the people of Australia. I mean, I think most people in this discussion these days kind of say, okay, it benefits us now to start talking. Or else, to your question earlier, when you tell the story, it kind of seems irrelevant. Name the potential threat actor. Most times, people will name it for you anyway if you just call it a sophisticated actor. And they're largely reasonably well informed, clearly, by naming those countries. And the world hasn't collapsed around us when we do name, because that's kind of what nation states should do to each other. I do advocate that if we're a liberal Western democracy and we believe in our values and the government says we'll push back on matters that matter to us, human rights and free trade and the like, let's draw a line and say cyber is one of those, that there are behaviours that are unacceptable and we should be naming countries. But I do think, in fairness, there's been a maturation. Maybe it's like a 2016 strategy to a 2020 strategy. Let's see if in the next couple of years Australia just comes out and starts being a bit more, into calling out the names.
Yeah, there has It has been a recent phenomenon, but a welcome phenomenon, and it's not just a case of naming and over what, but also what the consequences will be.
The so what bit.
The so what bit, and also to your point about the fact, Catherine, that about the what does it mean for the Australian people? Because it kind of seems a little bit stratospheric at the moment, and kind of out straight out of a Bond movie, but. What does it actually mean? What's the impact on the Australian people? What's the impact on their everyday lives? That needs to be translated. So it's not just the case of naming them and the consequences, or what outlining what they've done, naming who it was and the consequences of that action, but also what does it actually mean? What's the impact for the Australian people?
I don't like sophisticated state actors as a term, but it is a very sophisticated debate, and that's part of the challenge because, for example, I don't think it's just about warning the general citizenry or small or medium businesses, for example, about how their interests, their well-being, their welfare, their privacy is going to be affected. It's also about their responsibilities. And if you look at some of the live issues right now, if we talk about the future of TikTok or the future of WeChat, for example, including in this country, there'll be plenty of people, I think there'll be a groundswell of people who'll be really upset about losing, for example, the cultural and creative and novelty value of TikTok. Probably not the same number of people that hold concerns about human rights in China, but there is an important narrative that's going to have to be constructed in time, sophisticated and yet very simple in the way it's delivered, about the direct connection between the, the indiscriminate sharing of data or the provision of data essentially to a certain foreign state, and the really damaging repercussions that data can then have either on your national interest or your ability to build that foreign state actor's security capabilities, advantages, surveillance state, whatever it might be. So there's a huge amount of work that still lies ahead in getting these narratives clear and compelling, as frankly at heart they are.
And for our international listeners, Australia has taken a different approach to the US. There's no decision to ban TikTok, but the Prime Minister has said in public comments that it should be a buyer beware approach to those users who do use TikTok. And I think for the 6 million Australians using TikTok, a buyer beware approach does imply they need some level of knowledge about that threat landscape, which ties into what we're talking about. We're moving towards the end of our podcast here, but I do want to take us now to the international perspective. Alistair, you mentioned that Australia is a medium player in all of this. There's different things that we can do than the US, for instance, and we've shown middle power diplomacy by joining in on some of those multilateral attribution statements you mentioned. Rory, this strategy here flags that there is another strategy coming, which is the international cyber engagement and critical technologies engagement strategy coming out of our Department of Foreign Affairs. What do you think, what would you like to see in that strategy? And indeed, what do you think some of our partners in the region are hoping for in that next strategy?
Well, I think to the credit of the Australian system, there was an international cyber strategy, I think a year or two after the original cyber security strategy. I think it was in 2017, the international strategy. So there is good work in place on things like the norms and rules and the international system, trying to maintain, I guess, to the extent we can, the kind of free and open internet that we've believed in, although there's a whole fresh debate that I'm sure colleagues here would love to get into one time about whether it's actually in our interest to accept the reality now of the bifurcated internet that we're getting, and I'm probably moving towards that side of the debate. However, capacity building in partner countries was a high point of the existing strategy. Maybe on cybercrime, it might be fine if someone else is a bit slower when the bear is coming than you are. But on national security, I think there's a strong case to say that we want our neighbours to be able to run as fast as we can, or if not almost as fast as we can. And we want to help them get there because we want to build, I guess, solidarity in cybersecurity. So I'd like to imagine that whatever's coming as the next international cybersecurity strategy, and this time cyber and critical technology strategy, it really doubles down on that investment in capacity building, in supporting the cyber resilience of our region, even though there are so many other things that I guess in theory we could and should be investing resources in this COVID era. Just one point to note though, and an interesting slight tension in the debate is that at the moment our international strategy looks like it's going to focus on critical technology as well as cyber. And yes, critical technologies are defined as having that being underpinned by that information dimension that is cyber. But it's interesting that domestically at the moment we're still treating cyber and critical technologies almost as two separate sides of the coin. And I wonder if that's a sustainable distinction over time. Again, maybe it's another conversation to be had.
Gay, can I bring you in on that point? Because this strategy that we're talking about, the cyber security strategy, does take a very kind of traditional, I'd call it CIA triad approach to cyber. For non-cyber people, that's kind of protecting the confidentiality, integrity and availability of data and systems. It doesn't look so much about the other bad ways in which technology can be used or gamed to create national security outcomes. So, for instance, if we think about a lot of the most recent salient cyber attacks that we've seen, or cyber incidences, would be Russian state-sponsored interference in US politics. Most of that doesn't rely on cyber security or cyber or hacking. It results, it comes from gaming algorithms and spreading propaganda online, or even buying legitimate ad spaces on social media companies. Is it, to take Rory's point a bit further, is it sustainable for us to keep putting, or it seems in this strategy, to keep putting cybersecurity narrow in one bucket and then all of these other broader issues of kind of cyber safety online or national security and the technology intersection in a bunch of other buckets spread across government? I mean, how does that even work for a start? Who's picking up the pieces of all of that? And is that really a sustainable approach?
Well, it gets one of the points that was made in the industry panel report was the fact that we actually need to get, in a way, one point of truth and greater centralisation and consolidation of the way government agencies work in the cybersecurity space. So that didn't seem to get picked up much in this strategy, and I was a bit disappointed with that because it does, as you say, very much focus on ASD just in terms of the funding. You look at the funding and where that, the large chunk of that's going. It's largely in the ASD home affairs space. And so it would be good if we could get a consolidation of government agencies in terms of who was actually looking after, say, cyber policy and awareness and education, because at the moment it's spread right across a range of agencies, which is challenging for the Australian public. It's challenging for small business. It's challenging for critical infrastructure. It's challenging for large organisations. So that was disappointing in the fact that that was a very strong recommendation of the industry panel to actually get that sort of one point of truth, speaking with one voice, government agencies.
And there is a box in the strategy that tries to disambiguate cyber security from cyber safety,
yes.
Which from a bureaucratic perspective might be great, but I do wonder about how an ordinary mum and dad reading that might see that difference.
I've held both roles. I understand the call for this being in one sort of homogenous, centralised area.
I have been pushing it for a long time.
I know Gay has. And so as the eSafety Commissioner, you know, the benefit of that being a statutory position gives the eSafety Commissioner that independence that I think you want for working with those social media companies. I think the bits that's missing most, and so I really, you know, and I think the eSafety Office has grown really well, particularly under the second commissioner, which but for the listening audience was not me. It was my successor, Julian McGrant, who's stuck at it and done a really good job. But I think the bit that's missing more than anything is the threat to democracy by misusing technologies, the nub of your question. Because people don't read the newspaper now. They consume online information very differently. They're not reading the online newspapers even. They're going and finding it through their social media feed. They're not watching the evening news. We know all of this, right? The media company results will show you where the eyeballs aren't. That means that the information can be much more easily manipulated using those algorithms, using those very unregulated, non-journalistic sources of information. That's a huge threat to our democracy. And as a liberal Western democracy, we're very uninclined usually to start saying where we think something is untrue. And we sit through these elections. State elections matter an awful lot. And a nation state, a foreign nation state, would have an interest in being able to manipulate those outcomes, as they clearly would from a federal election. Even if it was just calling into question the results of those elections, then that undermines the very democracy. The most critical piece of infrastructure we have in this country, I used to say this all the time in the public service, is our parliaments. Because the parliaments are the voice of the people. You might have to squint occasionally to see the, you know, it's a bit like a Monet. It's not always a perfect reflection of those same barbecue conversations they have, but it's a pretty good approximation. And all public servants in this country answer to that democracy. If you undermine that parliament, then the whole thing falls down. And what I don't see is enough emphasis on protecting our democracy, our number one critical asset as a nation.
Look, that seems like a perfect point. If a pessimistic one, perhaps to end the podcast on, there's so much more we could talk about and we will hopefully engage with it over the coming weeks and months. Thank you very much, Gay, Alistair, Rory, for your contributions and analysis of the 2020 cybersecurity strategy.
Thank you. It was a rallying cry.
And a big thanks to Gay, Alistair and Rory for joining us on this special episode today, as well to Catherine for her deft handling of such an important discussion. As Rory mentioned, we are all on the front line of national security now, not only because we ourselves spend so much of our personal and professional life on the internet, but also because of the data we unconsciously give away through the Internet of Things, such as the camera in our doorbell, our children's toys, our smart televisions, or even the networks within networks, such as our smart homes, or even our family car. So your views on these issues are important to us, and we would love you to join the discussion, which you can do by getting in touch with us on Twitter using @ApsPolicyForum or @NatSecPod. You can join our Facebook group at Policy Forum Pod, or you can go old school and send an email to podcast@policyforum.net. Of course, we appreciate any rating and feedback you give us on whatever platform you pod with, and we love it when you share this pod with a colleague or friend. So thanks for listening to this special episode, and we will be back to speak to you again soon on the next episode of the National Security Podcast.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.